This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it at Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. In his remarks to the American public on October 19th, President Joe Biden said, quote, "History has taught us that when terrorists don't pay a price for their terror, when dictators don't pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos and death and more destruction." Biden was referring to the Palestinian militia known as Hamas, which carried out a series of deadly attacks inside Israel on October 7th. But Norman Solomon, my guest, says that if Hamas is a terrorist organization, then, quote, "the same description fits the Israeli government." Why is language so important when discussing this war? Norman Solomon now joins me. He is the National Director of RootsAction.org, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book is entitled War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. It's published by the New Press. He also just wrote a story in Counterpunch entitled "Hamas is a Terrorist Organization, So is the Israeli Government." Welcome to the program, Norman.
Thanks, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what it means when presidents use the word terrorist and what it actually does to help create justifications. We have seen this before, right? We've seen this specifically after the September 11th attacks, when George W. Bush, then president, identified what he called the axis of evil, and in using that word terrorist, launched not one, but at least two wars. Does this frighten you, the language that Biden is now using?
Well, it's very frightening because of the implications, and the war snare drums, you might say, are really beating. When a president talks about terrorism and how it has to be stopped, unfortunately, that means to the world, do as we say, not as we do. There are so many layers of bias in terms of national interest, in terms of ethnocentric and racial bias, in terms of our allies have the right, even we're told the duty, to, quote, defend themselves by killing civilians, whereas when the shoe is on the other foot, well, that is horrible. What we need really is a single standard of human rights and international conduct. And essentially what the Biden administration is doing in the tradition of one president after another is saying that we have the right to define what the rules are. The current buzz phrase is rules-based order, which really means we make the rules, we break the rules.
Let's actually take a listen to some excerpts from Biden's address given in the Oval Office last Thursday.
We're facing an inflection point in history. One of those moments where the decisions we make today are going to determine the future for decades to come. That's what I'd like to talk with you about tonight. You know, early this morning, I returned from Israel. They tell me I'm the first American president to travel there during a war. I met with the prime minister and members of his cabinet. And most movingly, I met with Israelis who had personally lived through horrific horror of the attack by Hamas on the 7th of October. You know, the assault on Israel echoes nearly 20 months of war, tragedy, and brutality inflicted on the people of Ukraine. Hamas and Putin represent different threats, but they share this in common. They both want to completely annihilate a neighboring democracy, completely annihilate it.
And that is President Joe Biden last Thursday, just an excerpt or several excerpts from the address that he made, where he announced additional military aid to Israel and to Ukraine. And it was interesting, Norman, in that speech, he tried to draw an analogy between how Ukraine was being attacked by Russia and how Israel was being attacked by Hamas. When, of course, the opposite analogy might be a little bit more accurate when we're talking about especially disproportionate force, right? Russia's military is much more analogous to Israel's military than Hamas, right?
This is really an example of the irony-free zone that really prevails in U.S. foreign policy issues on Capitol Hill and at the White House. When you look at the absolutely indefensible Russian invasion of Ukraine, there is a parallel. with what Israel is doing to Gaza as we speak, has been doing for more than 2 weeks now, overpowering use of weaponry, air power, and not only the ability, but in effect, an eagerness to terrorize civilians. And this is part of the predictable pattern. You know, one of the canards is that, oh, well, the other side, whoever those bad people are using their weapons intentionally to kill civilians. We don't do that. Right. Well, that's a distinction without a difference. Every leader of the Israeli government, and Biden, if he isn't in total denial, knows that many civilians predictably will be slaughtered by the offensive that Israel continues to engage in. The facts are in, the statistics are in. Every human being is not a statistic, but when we tote up the numbers, we have thousands and thousands of Palestinian civilians who've been killed already, many of them children. So we're in a deep Orwellian zone right now of doublethink, of newspeak, of manipulation of language in the service of slaughter, which is being implemented by the Israeli government with U.S. government support.
So basically, we have a scenario where Hamas is terrorist because it deliberately targeted civilians, but Israel is not a terrorist because any civilians that die at Israel's hands are inadvertent deaths. This is, of course, very similar language to what the U.S. used in Iraq and Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks, right?
Yes, it's a sleight of hand or a sleight of tongue, manipulation of language, distinctions without differences. And when you look at what actually happened in the first couple of decades of the so-called war on terror, which actually continues, driven by the United States and many countries, you see the consequences. Fairly conservative data coming from the Cost of War Project at Brown University tells us that at least 400,000 civilians were killed, primarily but not only, in Afghanistan and Iraq as a result of the post 9/11 US wars. It's very difficult to get that kind of information into US media. The denial is routine, and a lot of the excuse is, well, we didn't intend to do it. Well, that makes virtually no difference to the civilians who die as a result.
I want to quote for you, Norman, and for our audience, a really interesting tweet by the UN Refugee Agency, and I'll put it up on screen for our video audiences, just to give an example of the way in which language is weaponized. The UN Refugee Agency lost a number of its workers in Gaza, and they posted a tweet. The official account posted a tweet saying, "We are lost for words. We pay tribute to our 35 colleagues who have been killed in Gaza since 7th October. We grieve and we remember. These are not just numbers. These are our friends and colleagues. Many were teachers in our schools." UNRWA mourns this huge loss. Norman, in this scenario, the colleagues have been killed. It's a passive statement. There is no identification of who has done the killing. Forget about calling Israel a terrorist government or terrorist state. Israel is absolved even of killing non-Palestinians if they happen to be in Gaza. Does that make a difference? Does that impact how we think about these tragedies and this conflict and this war? It's not even a conflict, it's really a war.
It's part of the language that tilts people away from accountability and holding governments and other actors accountable. When we hear words like retaliation, well, both sides are saying they're retaliating. It's like a Greek tragedy. Both sides say they're retaliating against the other side, which did something before that, but it's virtually unheard of in U.S. news media to say that Palestinians are retaliating. It's always that the Israelis are retaliating. It's exculpatory defense. We hear that Israel is defending itself, whereas Palestinians, are they not defending themselves? We don't hear about that. When we get back to that boilerplate word, terrorist, we can find innumerable examples. It's routine when US news media, the mainstream, refer to Hamas terrorists. And I think that is an accurate description given what happened a few weeks ago. How often do we hear US mainstream media news reports refer to Israeli terrorists? The fact that we virtually never hear that tells you a lot about media spin and media bias. And if you have a single standard of human rights, then certainly what the Israeli government has been doing is just as terroristic as what Hamas did a few weeks ago and on a much larger scale.
So there's the culpability of the killers, and then there's the valuation of the lives on the other end. Does this language also obscure the value of Palestinian life and imply that Israeli lives are simply more important and worth more than Palestinian lives?
Well, it obscures the humanity of some people on the planet. And this is something that really struck me as I was working on the War Made Invisible book. I came to think of this as a system, a sensibility through the government and media of the United States to establish essentially, unconsciously, quite often, two tiers of grief, the grief that matters and the grief that doesn't. The grief that matters is US soldiers, their loved ones, and so forth, and then designated allies, Ukrainian people, Israeli people. That is the grief, the tier of grief that matters. And I think that grief does matter. But there's another tier of grief that is very implicit and insidious, and that is that this level of grief doesn't matter. People who are at the other end of US firepower, people at the other end of Israeli firepower. And this is morally and ethically corrosive. It corrodes our government, it corrodes our media, and it corrodes ourselves.
Do you feel that there is a little bit of a change in the way in which language is used? Because the Israeli war on Gaza has been ongoing. When it's not actively bombing Gaza, Israel controls its borders, controls who can enter and exit, controls its resources. Periodically, every few years, we have a massive disproportionate bombing campaign. And across the years, have you noticed, forget about setting aside politicians and Joe Biden, who seems to really have gone the opposite direction, but at least in the media, in terms of the voices that are allowed, and perhaps in Congress, where we have slightly more diversity of voices, do you see any kind of a change in the language used when describing this war?
Any change is the result of the organizing and activism and independent progressive media that have been focused on Palestinian rights and Israeli abuses of those rights for decades. This has been a long incremental effort from the grassroots for people and by people who believe in a humanistic view of the world, who don't tag some people as less valuable in their lives than others. And I think it has had some effect. We still have overall pretty atrocious mass media coverage in the United States of this current war going on with Israel and Gaza, but it's not as bad as it used to be.
When we also look at the way in which Gaza is described in an ongoing basis, right, we hear about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza as if there is this poverty and suffering that is almost unnatural. Again, there's Israel as the perpetrator is simply not identified. It certainly may have the effect of incurring pity or sympathy for the Palestinians, but not blame for the state of Israel, right? As if it's just something we must accept as sad.
It gets back to the paradigm of victims without victimizers. The passive voice, as though this is sort of a natural occurrence of events. The Middle East Journalists Association issued a statement soon after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, pointing out that there was a lot of Western, including US media coverage, saying, how could this be happening? This is Ukraine. Some reporters from the US said, these are people who look like us. And it was a way of conveying directly and indirectly that it is natural for people of color in the third world, in the global South, to suffer from wars. And that is not only a description of the situation, it's prescriptive. So we need to check ourselves at the door and really challenge this implicit racism, this ethnocentrism, and this acculturation to believe that some grief is more important than other grief.
Finally, Norman, how much power does the U.S. wield in this war? Setting aside the military aid, and we have a separate discussion on our program today about U.S. military aid to Israel, but even just in terms of rhetoric, if the U.S. were to, and if our leaders and media were to dramatically change the rhetoric so that it was fairer, so that it was more accurate, do you think that it would sway enough among the American public to change the dynamics? How much responsibility does the U.S. bear in everything that's happening, even setting aside the actual money and weaponry that we use to aid Israel?
More balanced and equitable rhetoric and diplomacy could have a huge effect. The United States no longer vetoing resolutions relating to this conflict, the most basic resolutions, such as for a ceasefire. The whole tone and tenor, the obedient, with some exceptions, a couple of dozen as we speak, exceptions to the rule, the dominant, even among Democrats in Congress, to not support a resolution or a ceasefire. This is really basic. And the Biden administration, the executive branch, and the leadership as it is in Congress really are setting a tone of acceptance for from-the-air killing of civilians on a massive scale in Gaza. And we need to organize and confront and challenge that.
Norman, I want to thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Your book, War Made Invisible, I imagine, is in bookstores everywhere, and people can certainly get a hold of a copy. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Sonali.
My guest has been Norman Solomon, National Director of RootsAction.org, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and his latest book is War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He's just written a story in Counterpunch titled Hamas is a Terrorist Organization, So is the Israeli Government. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.